We continue herding our oxen tonight, and I would like to read what our placard says about the fifth talk, which is taming the ox. The whip and rope are necessary, else he might stray off down some dusty road. Being well trained, he becomes naturally gentle. Then, unfettered, he obeys his master. So we're getting some control over this ox. And so we want to know how we can do that. And so tonight, when we talk about taming the ox, we're really talking about taming the mind. Now, first I want to bring people up to this talk by saying that each of these talks can be as descriptive, it can describe everyone's practice at certain times. We don't have to think of them so far ahead of ourselves that they're far-reaching and untouchable. And I'll try to make some of the points tonight relevant to wherever we are within our practice. It also is a series of talk that stretches. It should stretch. A good Dharma talk should feel as if there's something beyond what I know that's being said. And so that we have to reach beyond the threshold of our understanding, our Dharma understanding, to begin to get a sense of where this might be directed. So tonight, hopefully, it will do a little bit of that as well. So taming the ox. I think we could sum up the problem that most of us arrive in the Dharma by saying we have spent our life believing what is in front of our eyes. Just how we perceive the world, how other people have told us to perceive the world, how we have learned to perceive the world through others' descriptions and our own inward dialoguing, monologuing really. And so, but it's problematic because it doesn't feel connected in some way. We don't feel connected to it, and it feels sort of like life is out there and we're sort of outside of it somehow trying to get in it. And so this feeling of being distant to living or being a sectioned part of living just is not very conducive to contentment. And what we begin to understand as we come into the Dharma is that there's a conditioned reality that thought has given the world and the objects it makes from it, from the world. We have learned to describe the world in terms of objects. Now, that isn't fundamentally the way it is, because when we're a child, it's not that way. When we're very young, before we have learned the vocabulary of what things are, things aren't distinguished by words. What does the world look like before we have learned the words that have made them distant from us? Well, we don't know because we can't ask a child. But we can come back to an understanding or orientation to a sense of not knowing within the world of objects. But first we have to learn how we have given our sanity, our separation, over to seeing the world in terms of multiplicity, in terms of objects, in terms of this and that and me and you. It's not hard to understand that that's been a conditioned, referenced way we look at the world, because if you look out from your eyes, you know and have learned what everything is. And the fact that you have learned what everything is means it's a conditioned way of perceiving. Are you with me so far? Have I stay there. I have to get over this to get on with the... So the conditioned reality of thought has made objects in myself different, somehow separate from one another. When I call something something, I'm separate from it. And I've learned to call everything something, so I'm separate from everything. Fair enough? And then there's the unconditioned reality that we are learning to approach, and that is the awareness that holds all the objects. And that awareness is not broken up. You might think of it as the space between objects. It's the thing that is the common element to all of life. And as we begin to practice, a funny thing starts to happen. The objects, our internal objects, our emotions, our thoughts, our physical sensations, and all the different experiences we have, when we examine them and don't run from them, which is the teaching, the things of the world, those experiences we have all along the way, when we bring them up close and look at them and not run from them, not be afraid for what they might implicate about us, a funny thing happens. Their substance breaks down. They become transparent. Now, you don't have to have practiced too long to have seen that. For instance, in your emotions, when you have seen your emotions up front, when you have been sitting and you're just steady and you feel an emotion, what you once gave a tremendous sense of substantiality to, when you see it, what is it? What is it? It doesn't have any substance, does it? Or when you start looking at the thought, your thoughts, when you break it down, when you really look, okay, what is a thought? What is a thought? You see, it's not substantial. And yet, from thought, things are made to be substantial. From emotions, things are made to have an emotional reactivity. But when we look at what the intermediary is between that which makes things substantial, we don't see anything substantial. And we begin to see that all the things that we have held together to be substantial, to be objects, when they are looked at closely and just seen for what they fall apart. They fall apart because we're not adding more words to them. They can only remain what they are to us when we keep giving them a word, a designation. We keep calling them something, it holds it to that expression. When we stop calling them something, they fall apart. And so we're beginning to see that there is some ability, we have some ability to bring the world back together again from the object consciousness that we have held the world to be. That sense of me here and everything else out there. And when we look at what that's built upon, we don't see anything substantially there. And when we release it, when we actually relax the need to designate everything, the world starts coming back together, and we have seen the ox. We have seen the ox. Now here's what the Buddha said when he saw the ox. He said, "O house builder, you have been seen. You shall not build your house again. Your rafters are broken, your ridgepole demolished. The unconditioned has been attained, and every kind of craving is destroyed." And we can get a sense that when things are not held in their distinguished word form, what are we going to crave? How are we going to be able to crave anything when things start falling back into their oneness unless we keep designating in him something that I need. And so when we get quiet, our cravings also get quiet. And the person who is craving gets quiet. And we begin to see that the sense of I, just follow this logically if you don't follow it in practice. The sense of I is held together also by a thought. It's the thought of I that needs something. Now, when we see that, we know the true nature of reality. We're not fooled anymore just because we continue to look out of our eyes and see the perceived old patterns of objects and subject being here. We now have come to a kind of threshold in our practice where we can't be fooled, where we don't have to worry about losing the ox. Even when we lose it, we know we're just momentarily under the water of the designations that we have always given life to be, under the water of the conditioned factor of mind, under the water of what we have always learned life to be. But that doesn't mean that that's the way life is. We're just seeing it from that conditioned point of view. And so if we're just quiet, and we can do this very quickly, just being quiet, the feeling of insubstantiality comes back as we train ourselves so, and the world starts forming links to itself. The object starts forming links to itself. And we begin to see that sense of oneness again. So it's never very far away, and it never fools us, no matter how deeply reactive we might be in the moment. We know that that's just the mind's coloration, distortion of a truer perception of things being together. So we still have lots of work to do because the world keeps forming itself into objects, and I keep forming myself into a subject me. So it doesn't mean that we don't have a lot of more work to do. It just means that the burden of proof is off. Getting to the point where the burden of proof is off. See, we put a huge weight on Dharma proving itself. You know, is there anything to this, we say, in our doubts? I mean, is there anything to this? I mean, I've been sitting a long time. Is there anything to this? I mean, what's to this? We don't understand. We look for something to quantify the fact that we've been doing it for so long. What have we gotten out of it? Which is the old way of thinking about life, isn't it? Quantifiable terms. Me and what I've gotten out of it. What am I doing this for? I want to know in tangible results what's happening here, and is it going to make me better? Right? But when you begin to see that the results are the intangible, is the fact that you lose the sense of self-reference, you stop asking that question. And the burden of proof is off the Dharma. You see that? And every time you do ask that question, you're looking at the Dharma from the wrong point of view. And reasserting the object consciousness of life. And missing the ox. So now we still, as I mentioned, we still have to learn how to walk hand in hand with this ox, which is the taming of the ox, which is the taming of the mind, as I mentioned. How do we work with the mind, given this new understanding of reality, having seen the ox? Now, we don't want to act as if the ox is separate from us in our practices. Up until this point, we've been working very diligently as a separate me to try to work towards coming to unity, which doesn't make any sense in any way whatsoever that you could be diligently working as a separate sense of self to come to unity. Just logically, that doesn't make any sense to do. So somehow, in one of our sittings, or some just through the organic evolution of practice, the long-term persistence doesn't have to be dramatic. doesn't have to be suddenly lights are on and all I see the truth of things. Over time, you just get a sense of things having a relationship that I never thought they did before. This takes persistence and consistency. You see, if I could just digress for a moment. Rightly so, people come to speakers like Joseph last week, fill the room. They want to hear what this man has to say. He's very well known. And then I may not see them except for the next Easter or the next Christmas when another renowned speaker comes in, and then you see him again. That's not the persistent or consistency needed. This needs a reliable consistency that every day I show up for my practice. Every day. And part of that for many of us here in this room is coming regularly to Tuesdays, because that's the Sangha component, the community component of that. And we begin to see, even if we don't, we don't really want to come today, and he's talking about those oxes again, I don't want to hear about those oxes. It's not a very well received, and I don't even know what he's talking about. All of that. If I picked my subject so that you liked it, I would stay very object oriented. Because you love that. It certifies your position in things. My job is not to make you comfortable. And to have the persistence, okay, you just show up, and I know most of you do. You'll find that over time, just from that, just from your willingness to come regularly, to sit often, to keep arousing the enthusiasm for this mystery in front of us, you begin over time to begin to perceive each of these ox herding frames in ways that are meaningful. Oh, there's a meaningful impact. And not even knowing when or how it happened, a sense that things are very different than I originally perceived them. There's something, it's not that everybody welds together somehow. It's not that. It's just that the space that has divided the objects fuse with the objects so that it's all one continuum in oneness. And, oh, wow, it's an amazing, amazing world. But now when we start practicing, having perceived reality in that way, we don't want to bring back a determined and reinforced separate way of perceiving life. So the practice has to be in alignment, in accordance with this new reality we have. And that changes everything. It changes our entire relationship to practice. Everyone starts off practicing from separation, re-hardening their separation because they know no other reality. Somehow, some way, light gets into all that darkness. And then with that, a turning happens, the great turnaround, in which our practice changes in accordance with the truth we now perceive. So I have listed 10 principles for working with the ox. So let's go through some of these. The first principle for working with the ox in accordance, in alignment with the ox of oneness, not with multiplicity. Again, our practice diverges radically, radically at this juncture, radically. We can't keep doing the same practices the way we've been doing, judging and all of the different ways that we continue to persist in our separation within this new perspective. It doesn't make any sense. What are we judging? Who's judging? So the first principle is a mind pitted against itself perpetuates the belief that it is something. In other words, when I'm pitted against something, when I'm struggling, when I'm resistant to something, I have to overcome, I have a mission, I have a purpose, and I have, there's someone here who's doing that, to try and noble, be noble in our pursuit. As soon as I pit myself against anyone or anything, then I've made not only that something into an obstacle, but myself someone who has to surmount it. I can't work that way anymore once I've seen the truth. So I can't work with what the experiences that arise in my life with a sense of nobility and struggle, and it takes away, believe me, all your drama. And many of us don't want to give up our drama. We're too identified within the image of having that drama. And but if you're going to align yourself to the truth, you see, and not just persist in the individual form, we have to work in harmony with that fact, or the mind will lead us asunder. Number two, and this is one that I have a whole talk about if you'd like to go to the web. It's called The Governing Laws of the Mind. It's the sense of self, the sense of me, is not outside of the mind looking in. It's a part of the mental processes of the mind. The I is a thought conceived as being outside the mind, owning the mind. But in truth, it's a thought of the mind. So I am not outside having a mental experience. I am being held within that mental experience. Now that's, how else can it work, you see? If I were outside having a mental experience, how am I ever going to harmonize myself? There's still two of us here. My mind that I've got to berate and get it, and me who's having the problem with my mind. But if I see myself as being a component expression of the mind, then I understand immediately, okay, you know, I can't create more aversion towards an experience, or I'm just refracturing, re-separating out the two hemispheres of the mind. I'm keeping them distant. And the point is to allow them to come together. When the I factor comes together with the experience the I is having, there's a wholeness of mind. The mind becomes whole, and it sees from wholeness. It sees wholly, wholly seeing. But it's a radical shift in the understanding of how to work with the mind when we see ourselves and perceive ourselves as being a part of the mind. Because then we try to get along with our neighbors, right? And so when an experience comes up, what are we going to do with it? If we're just another experience having a difficult relationship with this experience, what sense does it mean to continue the struggle within me? Now, what I want to show you is that you all know that in some way. You just haven't seen it sufficiently, repetitively enough, to fully embrace this principle. But you have seen, many of you have seen your mind in all of its manifestation. You've seen thoughts. You've seen emotions. You have physical sensations and you've seen your reactions. Where are you except that there are, all of those are just mental reactions to what it is that's being perceived from the experience of what's being perceived. There isn't a sense, if you look for it, of any part of you that isn't a mental experience. There may be some sense of the watcher who sees it as being outside of what it's watching, but with even more quiet within your practice, you'll perceive the watcher as just being a subtle, very subtle expression of thought that's being held at bay to the experience at hand, so that you can watch it. If you don't fight so that the watcher doesn't have some kind of judgment about what is being watched, it'll come back into the whole of the consciousness and be seen by the whole of the consciousness. Because the quality of the unconditioned awareness is that it sees everything but doesn't have a placeholder for that seeing. The nature of awareness is that it sees, but it doesn't have a reference point from which it sees. So you can't claim to be a certain place watching, but the watching occurs. And if there's a place where we claim reference to what is being seen, it's because thought, that subtle thought of I, is not being seen in that moment by awareness. It's unconscious to awareness. And what we're trying to do is to make all the mind conscious. Even the part, that little whispering part that feels as if, seems as if, it's having a whole reflection upon what is happening. So, number three. Because of this, I practice from totality, not from partiality. That I can't split anything off from the whole. This is the ox speaking now. The ox is teaching me now. I can't hold a certain part of myself at bay and say, well, that I'm not going to deal with at all. And I'll awaken from this part over here that I really like about me. It's all or nothing. Because to separate any part of ourselves away is to refracture the mind, redivide the mind, struggle, and form an unconscious component to the consciousness that it's willing to see. It's like I'm irritated, right? And so now the sense of irritation, because it's not being seen, it's not being conscious, we're not conscious of being irritated, we're going to bring irritation as to what we see, rather than to see irritation as being part of the mind. It now becomes part of the self that sees from irritation. It sees the objects and experiences and life expressions from being irritated. See, because at that moment the irritation is unconscious to the awareness. It's a part of the mind that is still unconscious. So if I'm willing to make the irritation conscious, then it won't spread its infectious attitude to other forms of experience. It'll be irritation for its own sake. Okay, I'm irritated. I can feel this. And it won't infect the other experiences because it will now be conscious. Unconsciously, it will infect everything. I'm irritated at you. That's an infection, isn't it? And it's because it's not being seen. It's not being conscious. We're not being conscious of the totality of the mind. So we can leave none of ourselves behind. Does this make sense? And it's helpful, and I've used this before, and some of you have found it very useful, that when you find yourself disgruntled and having a difficult day, just say to yourself, get somewhere where you can slow down, pause for a moment, and just say, not T-W-O, not to. And then what we have to do is to reclaim where we have broken off from the one, where we are moods, usually it's mood driven, where our moods are confiscating our attention so that we're not perceiving the mood, but we're seeing from the mood, seeing life from the mood. See, not to. Now we have to make the mood conscious. Not to. Because, and as soon as we do, then it all comes back into a totality. It comes back into the truth, the whole. Mostly, the fracture occurs from attitudes and moods and emotions. That is where the fracture occurs. And we believe so strongly in them that we're not willing to look at them. We love the personalization of our attitude. It confirms our life history. It confirms how awful my mother was. And I can carry this souring irritation with me, infecting everything from that assumption, rather than to look at the assumption straight on and to make it conscious. Number four, there is no better way to get trapped within duality than by trying to get out of it. So we love the challenge, the spiritual challenge of fixing ourselves, of resolving this problem of me with the final resolution. And so we're going to take ourselves, you know, to the chopping block in this thing once and for all. It's a very noble, it's one of the finest and most noble pursuits we can have. And it's the mind generating its own sense of me. It's the mind generating itself. The mind again divided in what it wants to do. Now it's a noble pursuit. Before we were sleazy, now we're noble. But it hasn't brought anything together just because now we're noble. We have to go move beyond nobility. The calling, it's a higher calling than nobility. Number five, invite consciousness into the mind rather than moving consciousness outside of it. Now, what do I mean by that? We're often conscious of, right? I want to be conscious of what I'm hearing or seeing or smelling or tasting. But there is consciousness within the experience itself. And if we're just quiet, rather than trying to shove consciousness out so that I can perceive what it is that's going on and be conscious to it, if we just allow consciousness to come in and show itself, reveal itself within the mind, rather than having the experience of being conscious. I know this is subtle dharma, but I want to stretch you. So in the middle of an experience, let consciousness arise within the experience itself. Presence come through the experience. Now we get a sense that nothing, everything has, is derived from the same element, is being birthed from the same thing. Because all things contain presence. All things contain awareness. But as long as we want to be conscious of something, it's as if it's self-initiated rather than inherent within the experience. So I'm just giving you some pointers. Number six, invite discernment into what you see. What discernment does is that it breaks the hold of our conditioned reference to things, our conditioned beliefs and assumptions. And those assumptions are automatic. We have an emotion and I'm angry. And you've made me angry. That's just an assumption that is knee-jerk response to having an emotion. So the most vital tool that allows that to be broken is to invite a question into this relationship within the conditioning. Like, did you make me angry? Let's just start there. How could you possibly make me angry? I must make myself angry. So we're beginning to track back the original cause. And now let me hold, be accountable to this anger. And then we ask questions about the anger. Is it true that I know the intended purpose of what that person did? Is it true that there's only one side to this issue? And we keep asking questions that back us and back our righteousness into a corner so that our righteousness has nowhere to go and can't keep confirming its belief in hatred to the world. This tool of asking questions about the assumptions on which our life is based is really essential to moving in and through the conditioned ways we see, because the conditioning is so automatic and so sudden and so radical that unless we have a tool that brings us back to ground level zero, we just are off and running in our reaction. And then maybe at night we'll say, wow, what happened there? But you can train these questions, this discernment into your practice on an ongoing basis so that you're always looking anew, questioning yourself anew as to what's really going on here. Not what does my mind love to believe, but what's really going on here. This, then, is the fourth foundation of mindfulness. I think the fourth foundation of mindfulness, which I call this kind of discerned inquiry into the dharmas of life, into life itself. What is this? What's going on? Really is the foundation for being one with the ox. Because it's not an effort. It's an inquiry. It's a question. See, question doesn't divide. Question doesn't make an assumption. It opens things up. It doesn't close things down with an assumption. An assumption puts what I assume pitted against everything else. But a question opens everything up. So it invites connectedness. And that foundation of mindfulness, the fourth foundation of mindfulness, really is the opening up beyond the references that we have given each and every thing in our life. It begins to open up. What is this? What is this? Okay, I call it you. Now, what are you? What am I? What is this? So everything opens up to a question. And from that, it invites union, not differentiation. Now, I have something here that's very important. I say selflessness flows out of self-love. And I have harped upon this in the past, but I want to just reinforce this. This is something every single one of us in this room can get our arms around. Maybe the rest of the talk is over our heads. I don't know. But this is a point that each of us can understand. That we're never going to explore what we detest. And self-love, selflessness flows. This is the reason that so many people have found a chord within Vipassana because of self-acceptance. A conditional part of that self-acceptance is having our ethical conduct in line. You aren't going to love yourself when you're paranoid and know you've betrayed and hurt a lot of people. We've got to get our ethical, our sila, and it's called in Buddhism, our ethical conduct in line. And then we get our kindness flowing. We start actively working towards a kind relationship. Because when you're at ease in kindness, so much of the disgruntled and emotional reactions that we have is because we lack kindness, we lack consideration, we lack tolerance, we lack an open and available relationship with things. So kindness and ethical conduct, integrity basically, are fundamental to selflessness, because it's only through those that there can be self-love. And then, once we are on stable ground from self-love, we can ask direct questions about the nature of self. Until then, we're really trying to avoid ourselves or get over ourselves. Ourselves are seen problematically. And we're never going to understand the nature of self when we're a problem to ourselves. So you can begin to see how all these things are tied together. We're only talking about one thing here. All of Buddhism talks about one thing and one thing only. What's the nature of this thing? So we take this platform that we have now developed of inquiry, and we begin to investigate struggle. And we notice that every time we struggle against something, we're dismissing it. We're dismissing it because we're not interested in it. We're looking beyond it. We're trying to get over it. We're trying to get through it. We're not interested in it. And how can we come to oneness bypassing life? So we begin to see that, all right, I have to have a different relationship. I can't struggle with things. I can't just be aversive to things. I have to bring everything in. And from our own inquiry, from the base of our own observation, from our willingness to discern and ask questions, we begin to tie up all the loose ends of our life, and where we have still lost ourselves in the unconscious and aversive reactions to life. Number 7. Instead of the me struggling with the situation, we allow ourselves to be caught. Right? Okay, so I'm impatient. Now just be impatient. Be impatient. Don't be a person acting from impatience. Be impatient. Be caught within your impatience. Instead of struggling to get out of impatience, or getting out of irritability, or getting out of annoyance, or getting out of whatever, be caught in it. Consumed by it. Let the fire of impatience burn us up. Why not? Now we're a bonfire to ourselves. It's beautiful, because when you stop running from yourself, when we stop running from the mind, it opens up like a picture window, as I mentioned before. It stops being the quality of impatience. Impatience was incited to riot because of our aversion to the feeling of being impatient. That's what's incited it. Now if we're not aversive to the feeling of being impatient, it has nowhere to go. And so it opens up to its harmony. It opens up to patience. That's what it opens up to. So we get to patience through the bonfire of its opposite. Now, we're going nowhere, but we're working hard. That's how it feels like. We're always there. Present. Bring conscious awareness to whatever it is that seems to throw us off the saddle. But we're not going anywhere. I can't show somebody, I can't say, call my next door neighbor and see what a wonderful job I did with my impatience. There's no tangible result here. Right? Except inside. Except inside there are ways to perceive it. Shifts. But get interested in how the self arises. It arises through inattention. It arises through being unconscious. That's the only, because the sense of self is the embodiment of unconscious. We can't be conscious to ourselves and remain and not know what the sense of self is. So as we begin to act in accordance and to know the sense of self, it just shows itself more and more. The conscious, unconscious, cordoned off area called me begins to feel invited into consciousness, invited into awareness. It isn't the rascal we're trying to chase down any longer. It's invited into consciousness. Now, I want to reaffirm what all of us are already doing. This talk goes a little long, so please be patient. I want to reaffirm that you haven't done anything wrong, right? Wherever your practice is just right for this moment and for you. We all start by believing in ourselves. Our practice moves towards the resolution of self if we stay aligned with the true nature of reality, not each of our individual nature of reality, not what we think reality is, but the truth of reality as perceived by people, teachers, or people who we respect or have some appreciation for where they are. And then we say, oh, so things are together in ways that I don't perceive. Let my practice be in accordance with that, even though I'm not perceiving from that. So then, because all of our instructions are towards that end, we don't say judge those thoughts. We don't say turn away from your bad emotions. We never teach that. We teach connectedness. We teach the reality that we are likely seeing. And so we have to get on board. We have to be in line with the purpose and intention of where this thing goes, so that we don't sidestep onto a tributary and get lost somewhere. Cultivation is important, and many of you have, it has its place. Character traits, if you develop a kind heart, a warm heart, you feel already the sense of contentment. The Buddha said, someone who knows love is very close to the truth. So when you have a loving heart, or when you start feeling that character developing, you'll feel more settled in yourself. When you feel more settled in yourself, you have a better availability to see from that sense. You'll feel happy. You'll feel resolved with some of the tensions, and you'll be able to see deeper and deeper from that sense of settledness. So cultivation of qualities of character can be very helpful for that depth of seeing and purpose. Already, we've learned, many of us in this room, to steady our attention sufficiently, to look and know the difference between thinking about something and seeing it directly for what it is. All of that takes time and a great deal of effort, and many of us are well on the way to steadying that. So whatever we're doing is fine, but I want to hold the end, bring the end back to and make it relevant to wherever we are and whatever we're doing. Because if we practice from the end, we will know our way. Taming the ox means the forces of ignorance are yielding to the power of wakefulness. That's what it means. We've let the genie out of the bottle already. The genie's out. You can't shove awareness back into yourself and forget about it. It's out there. But we have to step out of the way to let it spring forth. And it's a miraculous, miraculous journey. Which brings me to the eighth point. What works is not will but surrender. Surrender is simply the willingness not to be separate. dropping, surrendering our separation, our resistance, so to speak, to whatever it is that's arising. And that takes us to number 9, which is get to know the way of self. Understand when the self is talking. Get to know that little critter. Because it shows up in every judgment, in every reaction, in your righteousness, in our struggle, in our resistance, in having problems in life, in our drama. Get to know its traits, its quality. Don't begrudge its quality. Be a detective unto it. We're cultural anthropologists to ourselves. Like we are a foreign species. Wow, that's interesting. You see that come out? Wow, that's interesting. You make a problem to yourself, then you're just redividing the mind. But make a study unto yourself, you are solidifying wholeness. The self has a point. We're not trying to smother it from existence. Finally, number 10, nothing works but love, because it's the only thing that doesn't do anything to you. Every other motivation, every other strategy, you're out in the cold. Even your subtle, sincere determination. I'm going to catch that. And all permutations, unless there's a willingness to embrace what you see, what we see, this game doesn't go very far. So let's line ourselves up to that simple, simple equation of self-appreciation. Thank you all. Can we sit for just a minute or two? So the burden is off as we sit. The burden's off. Don't put a burden back on. Don't leave here feeling terrible. My practice is a disaster. Don't do that. The self would love you to do that. It would put itself completely and firmly back into the driver's seat of your misery. Be caught by your misery if you're feeling that. I love this series. Looking out, I sometimes wonder if anyone else does. But I'm having a lot of fun. We're just chasing down the ox. And what is the ox? It's now. How distant can now be? We make it like a tracking of some foreign animal. I saw him back in 1933. One of those was seen. Bigfoot, right? Bigfoot. It's like Bigfoot. Doesn't exist. Okay, any questions or comments? I guess I just... Yeah. Yes.
Sometimes it's kind of hard to tell awareness from the me that's watching.
Yes. Sometimes it's difficult to tell the awareness from the me that's watching. Well, don't get too disturbed by that. Just be relaxed within that and let that be a question unto yourself. Is there a difference between awareness and the me that's watching? That's a beautiful question to ask yourself, isn't it? And don't get perturbed by trying to figure it out into an end. Just be very quiet and gentle with that question. Let the question float with you. And get a sense whether it's the same or different. Don't take my word. you have to get quiet. We can get quiet together. Another way of asking it is, what is it that's looking out of my eyes? What is it that looks out of our eyes? And the best we can do is say, I don't know. You know, I really don't know. Do you know? Because I don't. That's as close as you're going to ever come. See, it's not, we're not trying to stamp it out. We're not even trying to catch it, cage it up. We just want to know whether we know what it is or not. If we know what it is, fine, let's deal with it on that level. But if we don't know what it is, let's deal with it as if we didn't. Because there's a vast difference in how you hold yourself when you don't know what you are. So that question is a beautiful one, Tracy. And let it sit there. Let it just sit there, float in you. And just when we have an intention towards a question like that, a result, I want to know. I really do want to know. I don't want to just ask it because it sounds great. I really want to know what that is. Then you and I will know what that is. We will come to the resolution of that. The heart will not be denied. I can promise you that. But it's getting to the point where we even want to ask a question like that. Most of us don't want to know that. We want to know what we are. Because we have such self-loathing, we need to offset the difficulties we perceive ourselves with some real gain. You know, this way we feel like we're offsetting the terrible sense that we drag about ourselves, the image that we drag with ourselves. If we are at least moving towards some sense of reconciliation, But that's a far different, although it's a phase of the practice. It's a far different question than, what is this? Is there a difference between awareness and the person watching? Okay. Thank you all.